Hey, this is Johnny Lee from JohnnyLeePhillips.com, and today I'm here with my good friend Jared Easley, who is the host of the Star of the Doubts podcast. Hey, Jared, I've been listening to your podcast for the past year, and it's really encouraged and inspired me through some tough times. I appreciate what you've been doing with Star of the Doubts, and I know that you've created this audio package of some of the best interviews you've had with your guests. Would you be willing to tell the listeners why you put this together?
Hey, Johnny. Well, first of all, I got to say thank you because you've been gracious enough to help me put this together. And yeah, I've learned a lot in the process of interviewing a lot of successful entrepreneurs about how they overcome self-doubt. And for anyone who enjoys this audio package of takeaways from the podcast, they can go and listen to more interviews at starofthedoubts.com. But that said, yeah, we wanted to put together just a little bit of some actionable steps, some different things to consider for the aspiring entrepreneur and for the person that already owns their business.
Awesome, Jared. Okay, well, let's kick off with Jeffrey Gittimer.
Do something positive every day. Stop exposing yourself to dumb things and wake up and read. If you're not happy with your job, quit. Everything doesn't play out the way you want it to. But you can't name me one thing that plays out the way you want it to. You have an idea, you have a desired outcome, not a goal, a desired outcome. And you get to that outcome however you possibly can. By training myself in positive mental attitude, and I did that in the 70s when it didn't really count, but it stayed with me. Your attitude stays with you.
Okay, and our next guest will be Michael Gerber.
The biggest obstacle I had was learning everything I didn't know by discovering what that was. And of course, at the beginning of anything, there's all that you don't know, but you don't know you don't know it. So absolutely clearly, the most clarion response to that question, what's the biggest obstacle you've had to overcome when starting your business, is the biggest obstacle everybody has when they start a business. And that's learning everything I don't know by discovering what in fact that is.
For our next guest, we'll be talking to Derek Halpern.
I didn't really have self-doubt when I launched Social Triggers. I was 100% certain it was going to work. Actually, I was so certain it was going to work. Back in February of 2011, I was having lunch with a friend named Terry, and I was complaining about how bad most marketing blogs were, and he just looked at me. He goes, all right, Derek, do something about it. Like, challenge me to do it. And then I launched Social Triggers the next month, and I had 10,000 subscribers in the first 45 days or whatever it was. That said, I did struggle with self-doubt back when I was first getting started building websites. And what I did to overcome it was I never blamed anyone else.
I love this next interview with John Acuff. Let's kick that off.
Participate. Nobody on the sidelines wins ever. Doing stuff. You can't kind of think your way to your niche. You got to kind of get out there and try stuff. So, you know, trying a lot of different things, writing a blog, trying public speaking. You've got to try a bunch of different stuff. Based on what you've tried, you get a sense of, okay, these are the things I felt good at. These are the things I liked. The time moved slowly when I did this, or it moved quickly. And so I think you can kind of get a sense then.
What's your best tip for public speaking?
Don't be cocky. Our ego kills a crowd more than anything. You can't be the star of your own success story. I think a big part of it is having people around you that can help you with that. You know, because sometimes we're so close to it, we don't know that we're in over our head. So I would say having people that, your spouse, your family, your friends, that will say, hey, I feel like you've kind of gotten too far down this one path. Or, like, that's a key to me.
So those people just come and talk to you about it, and then you use that as your red flag, so to speak?
I use that as a barometer. I can't wait.
Here is Gary Vaynerchuk.
Very carefully and extremely not carefully, meaning it's the only thing I think about, but I'm not crippled by its magnitude. And that came out right. I like how that flowed. That was the answer. It's something I think about constantly. I finagle. I take red eyes. I tweak. But at the same token, I know who I am as a human being and what gets me up at night. And it's my family, but like, I'm an entrepreneur through and through at its raw state. And extremities, really being all in with the family when I'm with them and being all in to the career, making it very black and white, not trying to blend them, which has been helping me. by making the leads come to you. And what that means is by telling your story at the highest levels and letting the rain trickle down to you.
I'm so excited about our next interview with Pat Flynn.
It was initially launched on the Snippet app, which is for iOS only, and it's sort of a new sort of platform that sort of changes the way we experience and read books to a point where it's not even about the text anymore. It's about the overall multimedia experience, including social media right inside the book. And so I initially launched it on that. Immediately, a few thousand copies sold, and that was amazing. It's still the number one book on that platform. Let Go Day marks the five-year anniversary of me being let go from my architecture position, which obviously I talk about in the book, and that's why it's called Let Go on one level. But also, it changed the rest of my life, that, you know, being let go. And it was something that I was just so incredibly angry about at the time it was happening, just disappointed, upset, sad. And it actually turned out to be such a big blessing in disguise. So I celebrate it. I run a business and I'm marketing, and this is sort of a marketing strategy. You know, we're using this five-year anniversary and the fact that Let Go is out there, and the fact that there are, you know, a number of people who have enjoyed it already, to give it sort of a second wave and a second push. And we're actually just experimenting to see what can happen when a book has been out there already, if you can push it out there again. If I were to publish a new book, what I should do, or what potentially I could do better. And one of those tactics was to get ambassadors to help you push your book for you, to get people who believe in your message, who really believe in the book, and who wouldn't be afraid to share it with their friends, family, and followers to sort of help you. And another tip you gave was to sort of make an event out of the launch of the book. Even though things were going really well, it wasn't always, you know, a straight shot to the top. It was a bumpy road, and there was a lot of ups and a lot of downs. And then all of a sudden, I get this letter, a physical letter in my mailbox from the United States Green Building Council. And that is the company that actually administers this exam. And I opened up the letter, big, bold letters. All I saw was cease and desist. And I was just, I flipped out. I couldn't read the rest of it. I just was panicking. And I read, like, if you don't comply within 14 days, we're going to sue you, or something to that extent.
And up next is Michael Hyatt.
Life planning is something that really shaped my life. And it's something that I began doing in 2001. And it was really as a result of thinking I was having a heart attack. I wasn't. Turned out to be an acid reflux issue. But I realized that about the third time I went into the ER, that the doctor, the cardiologist who ended up diagnosing me, he said, look, he said, a lot of this is stress-induced. And he said, if you don't change your lifestyle and become more proactive and intentional with your life, you could end up in the ER with a real heart attack that just is coming out of the stress that you're bringing into your life. What matters most to me? You know, not to your spouse, not to your parents, not to your employer, but what matters most to you? What are the priorities that you're going to embrace, and how are you going to implement those in your life? And then the third question is, how do I get from where I am to where I want to be in every area of my life? And so the book kind of takes that basic structure, questions, keyword, sure, from SCORE, right?
Right.
And so the whole book scored like that, and that's the book. So we're working away on it now. I think what Ken said today, which was practice on your feet out loud. So whenever I'm giving a speech for the first time, I will always practice it, sometimes several times. I gave a new speech recently in Dallas, and I practiced it three times on my feet out loud. It just gives you such more confidence and agility when you're actually giving the speech if you've been through it before, rather than you're making it up for the first time in front of a live audience. One of the biggest challenges of SCORE is that you're speaking to a small group of people, and you know that the coach is there to critique you, and it's pretty nerve-wracking. I mean, you've just been through it.
Right.
So you know how that is. I would say, and I'm going to actually tell this story tomorrow, if you want to ratchet that up, then you get asked to speak in front of all the SCORE coaches, like I do now. And the first time I did that was in Vail, Colorado. I thought I was going to die. And I've been speaking for 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, in all kinds of contexts, thousands of people. But in front of that group was really, and they're very gracious, very forgiving. Everybody was very encouraging. But in my mind, it just felt like it was a huge deal.
Let's check out this interview with John Miller.
A number of people in my life have said, you need to change. And I, of course, being assertive, have said, you need to change. And this whole concept that I can get out of bed in the morning and ask that incredibly ultimate QBQ, we teach this in all our sessions, the ultimate question behind the question is, how can I let go of what I can't control? Said differently, what can I do to change me? Real accountability means, well, looking in that mirror and saying, what can I do to be a better person today? How can I improve me? And that, Jonathan, is the idea that excites me. You know, we're human. We all have fears. We all have apprehensions and uncertainties. But here's what you find with winners, people who just win. You know, nobody's a loser, okay? I'm not saying that. But people who win, they win at this, they win at that. You know what they do? They fall forward. Winners just fall forward. Every single time they hit a roadblock and they're down, they get back up. They move forward. And that's where the QBQ comes in. As we say in the QBQ book, I'd rather be the person who is told to wait than be the person who waits to be told.
Hey, this is Chris Brogan from Owner Magazine.
Human business is sustainable relationship-minded business. It's this concept that you could have relationship-based business with good, strong referral bases and a real outcome concern for what your customer or client is getting. And I use that to really separate between that and people who are going for much more transactional-based businesses, especially because a lot of what I do happens to be on the internet. Even though I do work with a lot of offline businesses, I'm trying really hard to distinguish myself from a certain class of online business person who really just kind of churns and burns their email list, for instance. And so what I'm explaining is, like, when I get the chance to work with a company like Molson Coors or Microsoft or anybody, what I'm bringing to them is sort of my philosophy that relationship-minded business is going to get you a lot further. And I think that it works for the individual kind of organization. I mean, that's who I work with now more often. It's just, you know, solo professionals, even if their day job happens to be at Molson Coors. But what I'm trying to get them to do is, you know, really connect in a human way. Probably the biggest thing to understand is that, like, everything comes in time, that you have to really tend and nurture. And that's where everyone kind of makes the mistake, Jared, is because if you start looking around for some new way to do something and you stumble into my model and you happen to be at a spot in your life where things are not going so well, or, you know, you've really got to work hard, or you got to dig yourself out of a hole, my model is not the right model, because it's like saying, oh, you're hungry right now, you should go plant a garden. So there's that kind of a challenge going on in that business, because people really need to do the work to get the result that I'm preaching. Helping people tell a bigger story is helping them really understand what's going to matter to their buyer, what's going to matter to the community that they have the opportunity to serve, and what's going to get more people to pay more attention.
Tell the bigger story without being self-gratifying.
Tell the story of them. Make your buyer the hero. This is like I could say this every single day, and it's really funny because sometimes I feel like I say it every single day. And furthermore, what ends up happening is that people end up pushing forward information is very specific to, like, what they do or what they sell. Make the buyer the hero. Tell them, and it's going to do a lot better.
Next, we'll be hearing from Rick Mulready.
Twitter, I've really found the ability to engage with them, have conversations with them, have quick conversations with them. I love their search functionality. You can find the conversations that are going on so that you can go and listen to those conversations and add value and so forth. So I do love Twitter. But you don't start yelling about your business or just right off the bat talking about your business. You start listening to the conversation and then, you know, adding value where you can. So that's really the best formula. As long as you're starting out by adding value first, and then you can mix in the sales messages from there. I think it's a good practice personally to follow back people who are following you. And, you know, like I said before, it's going to be very easy for people to unfollow you just as it was for them to follow you. So I do think it's a good practice to follow people back. You know, a good way to build up that Twitter presence and the Twitter followers is to start following people who are following other, quote unquote, I hate this word, but influencers in your field. And so if it's a big brand, if it's a well-known, again, another word I'm not a big fan of, a well-known expert, if you will, go into that person's followers or that brand's followers and start following those people. And again, that reciprocation often happens. So they start following you, and that gives you that opportunity to start engaging with them. I'm on this big journey to connect with the heads of social media from the biggest brands in the world. And that does include, like you mentioned before, people like Gary Vaynerchuk and Ted Rubin and Chris Brogan and so forth. Because I really think that one of the best ways to learn is to model someone who's doing it well in the industry or what you're trying to do yourself, and look at what they're doing and model and apply that for whatever you're trying to do. do as much as you can on the side while you have your job, and really start to hone your craft while you have that job. And, you know, start to make those connections. It's all about, and I don't mean that in like a sleazy kind of way. I mean, really develop genuine relationships with people in your industry while you have that job. You know, work early morning before you go to work, or in the evenings or on the weekends, or whenever you have that free time to do that, you know, spend that time to really start to build up that, and leave with a plan, you know, have a plan in place, and put that, whatever that date is, put that out there and sort of draw that line in the sand. And that's really going to motivate you to hit that date. And that really worked well for me, because I did have a date in mind, and that's what I was really shooting for. And, you know, I did have a savings goal and all that stuff. So, you know, make sure that you do have a plan in place and go for it. It sounds so cliche and it's talked about all the time, but it really is true. I mean, it's all about identifying somebody that you want to get to know, and don't go right after and ask them for something. I mean, really take the time to study them. And I don't mean that in a creepy kind of way, but just learn more about them, learn about the products that they're working on, and really figure out how you can add value to them, how you can help them, and, you know, approach them that way. You know, it's always good to try to meet people in person as well. So the more that you can get to conferences that are within your industry, you're going to run into those people there. And, you know, the more that you can do that, and the more that people can start seeing you around or seeing your name, it's just going to be that much easier for you to develop those relationships. And as soon as you start to develop relationships with a few people, you know, then they start introducing you to other people. You know, and I met, you know, you mentioned Pat Flynn. I met Pat Flynn through my buddy Adam Baker, who started Man vs. Debt. And Baker's been a friend of mine for a while, and Pat's been a friend of mine for a couple of years now. But that was, you know, that was a connection I made through a friend of mine. And now I'm business partners with them in something called Only 72. And so that relationship has turned into, you know, a business partnership as well. So just try to add as much value as you can to people, and don't go after them and say, oh, you know, can you do this for me? Or, you know, will you help me with this? See how you can add value to them first.
Our next guest is Michael Stelzner.
I recently went to Disneyland, and while I was there, I realized the last time I had visited was 7 years ago. Back then, my youngest wasn't even thought of, and my middle daughter was barely 1 year old, and my oldest was only 3 or 4 years old. Where in the world have those years gone? I've been working so hard for the last 7 years that my kids grew up way faster than I realized. But then while I was at the park, it hit me. Wait a second. We are the Indiana Jones generation. Where's that sense of adventure gone? Has my work really taken me away from my family this long? And unfortunately today, my kids are finding adventure by themselves with their devices and their game systems. I want to bring a real sense of adventure to my kids. I want to help other parents and grandparents create great adventures with their kids wherever they are. Think back to your childhood. If you're like me, you're hanging on to those awesome road trips and fun adventures. Wouldn't it be cool to take our kids on journeys, explore, create, and experience the awesome wonders of our world? What if there was a free resource? A recipe book, a step-by-step instruction guide that could help folks like me make moments our kids will remember. I decided it was time to build that resource. Sometimes all we need are a few good ideas to spark our creativity. This is My Kids Adventures. Will you join me? Let's bring fun back to the family.
Back in 2009, there were at least 1,000 other blogs focused on social media. And honestly, I didn't know very much about social media at all, Jared. So I had a heck of a lot of doubts going on inside of my head. But part of me said, you know what? This is marketplace justification. The fact that there are so many other blogs out there focused on social media, and in particular, you know, business people, marketers. That could have scared me from ever entering the marketplace, but instead I just said, well, that must mean there's a demand for that kind of content. So I used that as the impetus to move forward and take it to an entirely new level. But that was how I dealt with it. You know, I was just as scared as anybody else is when they're starting something new, but I just knew that I would bring something unique and different to the table.
Next, we'll be listening to John Lee Dumas from Entrepreneur on Fire.
But the things that I'm really most proud of and passionate about are the 15 video tutorials that I just include for free with the book. I mean, all ego aside, I truly do believe that those video tutorials could be packaged into a product and sold for hundreds of dollars. But that wasn't my goal with the Entrepreneur on Fire book podcast launch. I really just wanted to get out there in the Amazon marketplace, another one of those be everywhere strategies, and just provide incredible value like I've learned from Pat Flynn, like I've learned from Dan Miller, and kind of be looked at as the go-to source for that. And so the book went live, you know, a handful of weeks ago, Jared. Already has over 51 five-star reviews, which is incredibly high for a straight Amazon Kindle book. So I'm very proud of that fact.
Sure.
And I was really surprised at the lack of books on podcasting in Amazon. And, you know, I'm proud to say that it is officially the number one book in the Amazon store on podcasting. And I am very proud of that, too, because I do know that it does provide just incredible value for anybody that wants to learn more about this industry.
From 48 Days, this is Dan Miller.
Do you have any creative ideas on ways to spend time with high achievers?
I certainly do, and I see the power of that principle more and more and more. Just yesterday, I had lunch with a young man who's been involved in a very worthy cause for the last 7 years. In doing so, he has given and given and given. He's 41 years old. And I told him, I said, wow, in that period of time, now I've known him even back before he started with this organization. I said, you've lost touch with changes in the business and work environment. You've lost a network of connecting with high achievers. You have given and given so selflessly. You're drained. You're dead in the water. And he's like, wow. So we went to lunch together. I spent 2 hours with him yesterday. I took him to the Legends Club, Vanderbilt Legends Club. It's a golf club house here in Franklin. Very prestigious place. You know, the Vince Gill golf tournament is there and so on and so forth. I said, I'm going to give you an example of how easy this is to do. We could go to TGI Fridays and eat lunch there and listen to the mall employees bitch about the economy and who's in the White House. We aren't going to do that. We're going to choose to go where we're going to run into bank presidents, real estate developers, and people who are really changing the world. We walked into this very elegant environment, very quiet, great music, beautiful teak wood all around. First person I ran into was Daryl Waltrip. Hey, Daryl, what's happening? We sat down, ate lunch. He was like, wow, this is really different. I said, now, the point is, people think, well, gee, that's easy for Dan to do, you know, pay his annual fee to be a member there. Oh, you know what that cost me? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I'm not a golfer. I've never golfed. Have no desire to golf. But I'm a member of the dining club because I choose just to go there. Now, what that means is pay $6 for a salad. I mean, it's not expensive. And they send me a bill once a month for whatever we've spent there. There's no added cost in any way at all. It's just a different choice. But I choose in that period of time to position myself, you know, and again, not to be snobbish, but just with people who are performing at the level at which I want to perform. That's the real key. I mean, Jim Rohn said, we become the average of the five people we spend the most time with. Well, look around and you can figure out, what does that say about you? Is that what you want? So I choose, and it's very easy to do that. The same way, yeah, if you want to be skinny, golly, hang around people who have a proven track record of being healthy in what they're doing. Now, there's certainly going to be people, you know, friends and neighbors and family members who are not performing at the level which you want to perform, but you can identify limited time with those people. So there are times when you'll be around people that you'll spend an hour with, but you aren't going to spend 6 hours with them. You're going to spend a weekend with them. But you've got to make sure that you're not just being depleted by having people pulling on you all the time. But, I mean, I spend more time in environments where I'm not the leader, I'm not the teacher, I'm not the coach, in environments where I'm receiving, where I'm being taught, where I'm learning, where I'm being coached, than I do on the other side, even though that's what, you know, people often recognize about me. You know, I've always been optimistic. I've always been one to, you know, see the rainbow when other people are just complaining about the rain. I don't know. I just have so programmed my brain. And I think it's something I've learned, because it certainly is not borne out even in my siblings. But I just chose what I was going to read. I read success stories about people. I hung around successful people. And because of that, when I have a failure, I frame it differently than what a lot of people would do. I really believe that it's a necessary process on the road to success. I mean, nobody's success that I know had just a straight linear path upward with no discouragement or failure along the way. I mean, we've all stubbed our toes. But if we really believe that that is a legitimate part of the process, then we don't stay down. We come back up and keep going.
Next guest is Chris Ricardo.
I've got two mantras that I share with people. First thing is you've got to understand that your business is what you do, not who you are. So many people get so tied up in their business, in their leadership, in their whatever it is, that it becomes them. It becomes consuming. And when I say that, a lot of people don't even recognize that they're there. You've got to understand that your job is just a part of what you do. It's just a small circle in a very large circle of who you are. But for so many people, it becomes the large circle. And because of that, you become so emotionally tied that all decisions are difficult to make. They're emotional decisions. Some decisions are hard to even go after. So that's the first thing. The second thing, as a leader, you must understand that it is your job as a leader to make your team successful, not the other way around. So many folks that are in leadership believe that their team is there for them. You're here to make me successful. And that's just a horrid way of looking at leadership. By definition, if you want to know if you're a leader, turn around. If nobody's following you, then you're not leading. You don't know what leadership is. You're not making it happen. So instead, what I tell leaders all the time is, it's your job to get in there and make your team members successful. If I can duplicate myself and then do it again and do it again and do it again, then by default, I'll become successful in the process. The thing that you've got to know is, if you're doing what God wants you to do and you know it, then it doesn't matter what anybody else says. And if you're doing it to take care of his children, then it doesn't matter what anybody else says. That for me is what every day I have to tell myself. Because if you can imagine, I've been in a big world of leadership and teaching leaders and teaching entrepreneurs and coaching businesses and all this kind of fun stuff. There is not a lack of voices that want to tell me that I can't do what I want to do. So I have to protect my heart. I truly believe this. I believe that if you are diligent, then you prosper. The Bible says so. The diligent prosper. If you are diligent to be great at what you're doing and who you are, then opportunities are going to eventually open up for you. It's not saying that the other people that are back there that aren't being diligent don't have opportunities or God didn't want them in a better place. I'm just saying, don't allow that to suck you down into a black hole. Instead, focus heavily on being the best person you can be. And the great thing is that will start to rub off on everybody around you, and you'll bring a lot of people with you as well. Whenever I'm either teaching or whenever I'm doing interviews of trying to get information from great leaders, my goal is not to be the leader in the room. My goal is to be the advocate for the people who are listening. So if I'm interviewing a Maxwell or a Covey or Collins, my goal is to make sure that I'm talking to them about stuff that I really believe my listeners not only want to hear, but absolutely need to hear. So that becomes my goal. Be the advocate for the person listening. It's not about me, it's about them. And if I can do that, then great stuff's going to come out of it.
Our Our next interview is Amy Porterfield from amyporterfield.com.
What would you recommend in terms of modeling the best but also differentiating yourself?
Such a great point. I recently read a quote, and I got to go find it to really quote it correctly, but it was something like, don't just model the best in terms of copying. Take that as inspiration and then mold it into your own strategies and way of doing business. So the difference between, you know, copying what someone's doing and just modeling is understanding the principles behind something. So if I were to look at one of my mentors and notice that they're sending out a newsletter, which happened to me recently, I have a great mentor that sends out a newsletter for years now, and I love that newsletter, but I didn't want to copy it as well. So I saw the strategy she was using. I saw the tips she was giving and why she was doing it. I really studied it, but then I thought, how can I infuse my own personality? What's missing here that I know I'd love to add or talk about? So you've got to look at your own brand and your own personality and infuse that in everything you do, because copying is just not fun. Truly, I think my biggest frustration is letting go of some of the control in my business. I sometimes say I'm a one-woman show, but that's truly not the case in the sense that I have a wonderful executive assistant. I have a great project or content manager now. So this is something new on my team. And I have a project manager for my launches. They're not all full-time, but they're on my team. And they're constantly reminding me, Amy, you got to give that to us. You got to push it forward and let us kind of get in there and make it something great without having you do everything. So my biggest frustration is telling myself I've got to let go of that control a little bit and give it to my team. And once I do, I'm able to have that more freedom in my life, which is why I became an entrepreneur in the first place. So go figure.
Do you have any examples of ways that entrepreneurs can be very clear on what they're offering to their audience and how their fan base can do business with them?
Yes, a few different things. One is that you want to make sure on your Facebook page, underneath your profile photo, so you've got your big timeline cover photo at the top, and then you've got a profile photo. And then most people, unless you're a local business, you don't get this option, but most people have that box, that about box. And in there, you can put a hot link to your website. The reason why that's important is if I came to your Facebook page, I just might want to go check out what you're all about. And really, your website is where I'm going to do that. So you want to make sure people know instantly how to get to your website. And that's the only static place on a Facebook page where you can have a hot link to your website or to an opt-in page or whatever you want. In addition to that, fill out your about section on your Facebook page. Not only is it indexed by Google, but if someone's genuinely interested in what you're about, they're going to check your about page. They want to know who you are, what you're about, what you're selling, how they can work with you. You want to ask the question, if someone came to my Facebook page today, would they know instantly who I am and what I'm about or how to do business with me? One of the best ways to do that is to use your timeline cover photo. The timeline cover photo used to have all these restrictions. Now, it really doesn't have any restrictions. You can put your website, you can put a call to action, your email address. You can have a big button that says click here. When people click it, a light box pops up, just like any image on Facebook. And in the status update, you can give them links to go places to visit and find out more about you. That timeline cover photo is pretty much your first introduction to people. Use it to your advantage. Burn the boats means to decide on something you really want to do. You know, you've got this goal, you're going for it. And what you do is you storm that island, meaning you quit that job or you fire that client that's driving you crazy, or you start a new habit that you're going to stick to and really do it. And what you do is you storm the island and you burn the boats, meaning there is no way back. You can't change your mind. You're going to make this work. And I always tell that story because that's truly what I did when I left Tony Robbins and started my own business. There was no looking back.
Up next, we have Kent Julian.
After my first year, I have $4,000 total revenue. That's not income, that's total revenue to account for all that effort. I mean, you're talking somewhere in the $4 to $5 an hour range. And again, that's not income. That's not my paycheck. That's just the amount of money that I've produced. And then after 18 months, I add another $6,000. So you're at 18 months, total revenue of $10,000. And so when you're banging away at something really hard, doing the best that you can, and you've put in thousands and thousands and thousands of hours, and you've got $10,000 $1,000 revenue, you're doing a lot of, is this going to make it? I remember telling my wife after a particular seminar saying, if I did this every weekend, except for Christmas and Easter, and I did this seminar every single weekend, I'd produce $20,000 worth of revenue. I mean, those, you just go, how in the world are you going to make a living at this? There was a ton of fear. More than fear, it was just, is this actually going to happen? Am I wasting my time? And so I learned how to work through that and how to see whether this thing gets off the ground or not. I'm not wasting my time. There's different ways. It depends on what I'm trying to do. When I market my speaking, I'm marketing directly to event planners. So it's very different. It's very much you're reaching out to them and constantly marketing your services. When I'm marketing what I do through Live It Forward and what I do through part of Live It Forward is this speaker's boot camp I do called Speak It Forward. So if you go to liveitforward.com, there's links to Speak It Forward. So when I'm marketing those, it's much more doing blogs and providing content and that. But the key to both, here's the key to both, is that you serve and you add value before anybody ever hires you, and whether they ever hire you or not, you're giving and serving and adding value. So I'm trying to create what I call top of mind awareness with both of those markets. And the way that I go about doing it is to say, here's value. I hope you can use it in your organization, and I'm serving you. And the idea behind that is, hey, whether you ever hire me or not, or whether you ever use my services, I hope this helps you. E plus R equals O is not original with me. It's original with a guy named W. Clement Stone. I've read some of his books and read that in there, but also Jack Canfield, who was mentored by W. Clement Stone, will use it from time to time. And it's all it stands for is events plus R, response to those events equal the outcome. And so the concept is you're pretty much not in control of any events that happen in your life. You're not in control of what people say to you. You're not in control. You don't know what's going to happen 5 minutes from now. I mean, there's certain things you can control, but most of the experiences and events that come into your life just happen. And the one thing you're 100% in control of is your response. And the way that you shape the outcome, you can take any event that happens to you and shape it for the good by taking 100% control of your response.
I'm so excited about this one. We're with Seth Godin.
Seth, what are some tips or best practices for the listeners who want to find ways to better connect with their audience?
Well, I think the biggest one is to not look for tips or best practices. That said, there are similarities about what happens when you build a tribe. You know, it starts by understanding that we only want to connect with people who are generous and trustworthy. Because why would you want to connect with someone who is selfish and is going to steal from you? And generous and trustworthy aren't things that are easily faked, but they are things that are easily done if you believe them. Mm-hmm. So the more often and more eagerly you are helping people with no intent or plan for a recompense, the more likely it is that people will be open to you connecting and helping them. And what happens is people get hooked on that. They get hooked on the feeling of not being lonely. They get hooked on the feeling of someone looking out for them. They get hooked on the feeling of someone being generous. In my experience, if you are consistent in doing that, revenue really does take care of itself.
How did you overcome self-doubt when you were going through that season of your life?
Well, you know, my friend Zig Ziglar certainly helped a lot listening to his tapes every day over and over again. And what he taught me are two things. One, failure is an event. It's not a person. And each one of those no's was just a clue that I had created something that day that no one wanted, not that I was a bad person. And two, I viewed them as no for now as opposed to no forever. That if someone was taking the time to explain to me where I was going off the rails, what I was learning from that is I was selling to an industry that wanted to buy something, and I just wasn't inventing something they wanted to buy. And that what I had to do was more work on telling a story that they needed to hear and work harder at giving up my egocentric view of what they ought to do.
What types of resistance are you facing now in this stage of your career?
the resistance, as Steve Pressfield has written about so eloquently, is that voice in your head, the lizard brain, that tells you not to do something, that creates writer's block, that gives us an excuse, that helps us hide, that lets us postpone things. And as you gain a bigger footprint, it's easier than ever to bring stuff to the world. If Mario Batali wants to open a tofu and peanut butter restaurant, he probably can, because there are investors who will say, well, it's Mario Batali, why not? And what happens when you don't have the engine in the marketplace saying no, it's easier to do things that aren't scary, because you don't have to scare yourself in order to move forward. And for me, I seek out the resistance. I seek out that voice. It's the danger that I want to dance with. So what I try to do is, you may have seen I did a speech with Creative Mornings a couple weeks ago. It was all new material. And the reason for that is not because I needed new material. It's because creating new material and trying it out on a group live with a camera is really, really scary. I needed that fear, that resistance, in order to do my best work. Well, first, let's be really clear about wants to create art. If you really want to create art, you will. I mean, Charles Ives is one of the great composers of the 20th century, and he did very edgy, important work, and he did it all the while supporting his family with a full-time job in the insurance industry. We're not talking about reinventing classical music here. We're talking about writing a blog, or we're talking about helping a local nonprofit do scary work, or we're talking about making a 3-minute video on Sunday mornings. We can use all the excuses that we want, but the fact is there are people making art who have bigger excuses than you. There are people who live in the underprivileged world. There are people who are struggling with physical handicaps or are living in abusive relationships. There are people who don't have the resources you have, who are still finding a way to make art. So I don't think that Icarus is demanding that you make big art. They're demanding that you change the whole world. I think that the challenge is to make a little art often. The challenge is to say, I'm going to watch one less hour of television and do one more hour of generous connecting. It's not that you need to do a lot of it. It's just that you need to do it. Because once you get hooked on it and you're not hiding, I think you will find a way to do more of it. You said something right when we started talking about making a ruckus. And it's fun to use that expression. I use it all the time. But it's worth thinking about what that means, right? It means confront failure. It means disappoint people who are around you. It means question the status quo. It means indulge the voice in your head that wants to make art at the expense of the comfort of the lizard brain. And yeah, that's my final words. Go make a ruckus.
Up next is the podcast answer man, Cliff Ravenscraft.
Dan Miller taught me that it's okay to not hate work and make money. And what I mean by that is I had this super warped idea of work and how you make a living. And for some reason, I don't know if it was taught to me in a church somewhere or something, but I saw work as a curse. And it was something that we were doomed to do until we go to heaven. And it was some kind of penance to live or something. I don't know. But I figured that how people pay you is actually people pay you to do things that they would never want to do on their own. So the more you hate your job, the more money you should be paid to do it. And that was a super warped way of thinking. But I've shared that with some other people, and there's actually several other people that actually still think that. And Dan Miller actually showed me that it's okay. And not only is it okay to love your work and make a living from doing something you love, but really that's what we're designed to do. We're only, you're only on this earth for so long, and we have all been given certain gifts and talents and abilities and certain opportunities that exist for us. And why waste our life doing something that we hate? Instead, why don't we do something that we feel called to do, or something that we feel gives us a sense of fulfillment and purpose in life? And that's something. And of course, my favorite quote in the world, it's not a Dan Miller quote, but I heard it from him first. And that is, find something that you love to do so much that you'd be willing to do it all day long for free, and then become so excellent at doing that one thing that people will eventually want to pay you to do it.
Michael Hyatt.
Michael Hyatt, for me, I would say what I've learned from him is systems and also just delegating. His ability to consistently think, what is the most important thing? What's the most important task that I should be working on right now? And if I do not have to work on this task, or if there's something else that's more important that needs me to touch this, then I need to actually take this task that's in front of me and delegate it to somewhere else. Maybe I need to create a system or a process, but find the right people to do these things. The other thing that I learned from Michael Hyatt, and something that has been so important to me, is that I learned from him first, and he heard it from Andy Stanley. But from Michael Hyatt, I heard it from him, and he says, listen, you can't always serve everyone that comes your way. And I'm a people pleaser. He says, you know, you're going to grow to a place of success where so many people are going to reach out to you that you just can't answer everyone. And you'll come to that place where you've reached so much success that you'll actually have to do for some what you wish you could do for everyone. Just realize that you're going to get to that place where you can't do it for everyone. Because of that, I have learned to become an expert at the word no.
Michael Stelzner.
For Michael Stelzner, I would say what I learned from him is business sense. I've learned a ton of things about running a business and thinking and dreaming big, setting big goals and attacking them head on. You know, he's obviously very famous for his launches. He's got a book called Launch, and this guy takes no prisoners. When he sets a goal, he sets a big goal, and he attacks it with everything he has. He takes every available resource. And the other thing that I like about him is his willingness to always reach out and help somebody who he feels is doing something unique and important in this world. And in spite of the fact of how many people, you know, rely on him for information, he does that other quote that I told you from Michael Hyatt so extremely well. He does for some what I'm sure he wishes he could do for many.
Pat Flynn.
Pat Flynn. Well, I'll tell you what, I learned from Pat Flynn so many things, but I'll be forever indebted to Pat Flynn for his inspiration for me to start the Podcasting A to Z online training course, which is now absolutely the single greatest amount of income that I bring in. It never would have happened had it not been for my mastermind meetings where Pat would consistently share his, oh gosh, what was it called? Niche Site Duel or something like that. He was doing with another friend of his, and he says, hey, we're going to do this course and it's going to be $800 and, you know, we've got people signed up and this is how we're going to run it. And that was totally the inspiration I needed to actually create Podcasting A to Z.
And I'm an alumni of Podcasting A to Z, so thank you, Pat. Leo Laporte.
Oh, wow. Leo Laporte, I have him to thank for my continued love of technology. And for him, I absolutely look up to him for the way that he brings people together as experts and gives them the spotlight to shine on them. And he's one of those guys where you just see that, man, if you just bring other people who know their stuff and give them the opportunity to shine, you automatically shine as a result of that as well. And what he's done with his network over at This Week in Tech, it's just absolutely out of this world. He's now creating content. He's made, I think he's probably at the point where he's making about $7 million per year with his business. And I'm totally,
sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I'm totally excited about the things that he's got going on and the things that he's doing. Yeah, he's been somebody I've always looked up to when it comes to how to build a media empire.
Well, you mentioned tech and things of that nature. What's maybe the one app that you're using on your phone every day?
Evernote.
Evernote.
Evernote's been around. I tried Evernote when it first came out back in, I guess, 2006 or 7, and fell in love with it until I saw it had some syncing issues. I gave it up for a long time. I tried Evernote a bunch of different times. But about 3 weeks ago, I dove in headfirst to Evernote, and I'm completely won over. I probably open Evernote 8, 10, 12 times a day now.
Are you just doing the free version or the pro?
Recommend? I went pro immediately. I needed to be able to sync all my tabs. I needed to be able to, not all my tabs, but tags.
Right.
And I needed to be able to sync everything. I wanted the immediate sync and priority and everything. So, what is it? $45 a year. It's a no-brainer. How can I not pay that for something that's so valuable?
The last person on the list here that I wanted to ask you about is Rick Calvert.
Yep. So what have I learned from him? This guy has a passion for conferences, and what I've learned from him is that you can create an entire staff of people to help you pull off something that would otherwise be impossible. He has this conference, New Media Expo. I think we're expected to have 7,000 people in attendance in January.
Unbelievable.
And when you think that, when I went to my first ever, back then it was called Blog World, but when I went to my first ever expo that he created, it was way bigger than I ever dreamed or imagined. I mean, it's like I had gone to some insurance conferences, like, you know, this Applied System had this computer technology company had this Applied User Group, and they had this amazing conference. But this is, you know, this is a multi-million dollar industry, you know, and company. And so I'd been to a big conference, but I never expected, you know, a gathering of social media people to be as big as New Media Expo was. And that really blew my mind. And so what I've had the privilege of seeing is him allowing his team to pretty much take charge. I do have access, you know, as the director of podcasting for New Media Expo, I have access to Rick in a pretty amazing way. And he's always there for me when I need him. But he gives the authority to his staff to make decisions that, quite honestly, would scare me to allow somebody else to make for me. So it's pretty awesome. I've learned a lot from him and the way that he delegates and gives authority to his team.
You are the podcast answer man, and that's a given. But I've been watching you and listening to you for a long time now. And what I'm noticing, especially over the last probably year and a half, is not only are you the podcast answer man, but you're becoming more and more a go-to thought leader on things that are entrepreneur-minded, people who are interested in maybe taking that step and starting their own business. What's your opinion on that?
It's absolutely true, and there's no doubt in my mind that this has been influenced by Dan Miller. He's probably one of my favorite people that I follow, and if there's anybody out there that has a business model that my business is kind of modeled after, it's his. He's an author, I'm a podcaster, and stuff like that, so he teaches people how to write, he teaches people how to, and of course he also talks about career, but originally, it was about writing and being a successful author, building multiple streams of income around it. And what I found is that, you know, here I am, I'm a podcaster, and there are things that I can do. I could start teaching. I could start doing this. And I had absolutely zero business training when I launched my business. The only thing I had going for me is, number one, I love to talk. And number two, I love to sell. I was a good insurance agent. That's not true. I was an excellent insurance agent. I could sell ice to Eskimos. But one thing I didn't know anything about was marketing. I didn't know how to get people in front of me. I knew how to talk to people once I got them there, but how do I get the attention of people? How do I market to them? And then also, how do you create products and services? How do you deal with the demand of people on your time and all of these other things? My favorite story, Jared, how much time do we have? Because I have a story I want to tell you.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is one of my favorite stories. You know, I'm sitting here selling equipment. This is back in 2008. Yes, it was definitely 2008 because it was the year that I only made $11,000 that year, personal income. So it was 2008 and things are so bad. Stephanie's like, okay, I'm going to go get a job. And I'm like, no, you're not. I'm going to go deliver pizzas before you get a job. And so I figure I'm going to work 10, 15 hours a week delivering pizzas. Now, Jared, in today's economy, delivering pizzas, that's going to equate to after taxes right around $300, $350 a month extra income, right?
Awesome.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's if I'm lucky. And the deal is that's at least going to put $300 to $350 more worth of food on the table. And seriously, food on the table at that time was tough in 2008. But that was what I was willing to do. And on my way out the door, somebody calls and they said, hi, my name is so-and-so. I found your website on the internet via Google, and I see your phone number here, and I'd like to ask you some questions about some equipment. I have a tight budget, but I'm trying to build a podcast that's going to sound really great. And I sit there, I said, okay, how much is your budget? And he says, well, I only have $25,000 to spend. And I'm like, seriously? What are you, from the radio industry or something? He goes, yeah, I've had a professional talk radio show for the last several years, and the radio station is unfortunately going bankrupt. They're shutting things down, but I want to keep my show on the air. I want to turn it into a podcast. And this guy's been talking to the guys at the radio station. Of course, radio stations pay tens of thousands of dollars for one piece of gear. And so basically, I ended up selling him about $2,000 worth of equipment, and I made $350 in profit after just 25 minutes on the phone with this guy. I just made in 25 minutes what I was actually getting ready to go out and apply for a job where I would only make that much money if I worked 10 to 15 hours a week every week for a month.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, wait a second, I am not going to go out and get a job delivering pizzas. I'm going to hire myself to sit here in front of this computer and spend 10 to 15 hours a week every single week duplicating what just happened on the phone. And Jared, here's the deal. Type in podcast equipment in Google. And by the way, anybody in the world can do this. It doesn't matter what country you're in. Type in podcast equipment in Google and see what the first thing that comes up. It's me. And I got to the place where I was working 40 to 60 hours a week selling equipment. And by golly, I was making $4,000 to $6,000 a month in equipment profit. And things were really hot until I met Dan Miller. And when I met Dan Miller for the first time, and after spending some time with him one-on-one, he started referring clients to me, so much so that I took on 15 new clients in 10 days. I was having a hard time actually remembering their first names when I was on the phone with them, let alone somebody I'd known for years with you, Jared. But anyway, I was having a hard time keeping everybody straight, and here's the situation. I started to get so many clients, and by the way, my rate at the time was $150 an hour. You know, it's a whole lot more to do work with me one-on-one now, but back then it was $150 an hour. And people want to hire me, and I'd say, I can get to you in about 6 to 8 weeks from now. And that's because I was only doing consulting 2 days a week, because I could only do it that time a week because I had all these equipment sales and all of these one-off things. The thing is, I'd be doing all these proposals and diagrams for equipment, helping people out, taking things to a whole new level, and blowing people's mind with the service that I offer, doing things they would have never dreamed that I would do, and helping them in great ways. And the thing is, they loved it, but sometimes I would only make $40 profit. You know, sometimes it's $20 profit. And I've got hours spent into this, you know. So what happened was, I'm sitting there talking in my podcast, Pursuing a Balanced Life, sharing with people, you know, man, things are really great, but the thing is, man, I'm just struggling to keep up with it. And even at $150 an hour, there's not enough time in the day and stuff like that. I don't know what to do. One of my listeners then leaves me voicemail feedback. He says, Cliff, I'm going to give you 3 words that will change your life forever. And I said, what's that? He says, stop selling equipment. And for 2 months, I stopped selling equipment. Of course, it wasn't until the rest of that voicemail that convinced me to do so. He says, do the math. He goes, Cliff, I listen to your podcast. I've never missed an episode. I know how many hours a week you work. I know how much profit you make on equipment sales because you've been very authentic, transparent, and open with that. But dude, I did the math. Did you know you're making $16.50 an hour? I'm like, what? And so he actually sent me the equation. And I'm like, you're absolutely, he says, I said, you're a little bit off, but yeah, I'm making $16.50 an hour when you think about it. And I'm turning down $150 an hour consulting calls so that I can consistently make $16.50 an hour. And so for 2 months, I stopped selling equipment and I only did consulting calls, and my income tripled in instantly. So, you know, just those kind of things. These are things that I never would have thought of on my own. But through my experience, I've learned so many different things the hard way, and just from, you know, learning how things work. I feel like I'm a great marketer now. I listen to hundreds of hours worth of podcasts about marketing and sales and business and streams of income, passive income, all of these different things. And the fact that I've actually got a successful business that makes serious income now, I have gotten to the place where, gosh, just like before, people were paying for me to share my expertise in podcasting. I feel like I am getting into a place where people kind of see me as an expert in building an online business, because I did take, you know, here I am, a guy who knows nothing about online business or business at all. And now I've built this business, and a lot of people are looking to me to get some advice on certain things. And what's really weird is when I get somebody who is much older than I am, much more life experience than I have and stuff like that. And they're willing to pay $300 for an hour of my time. And at the end of the call, they're like, oh my gosh, that was so mind blowing. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm like, seriously? But yeah, I love helping people in their mindset, helping them understand how to do business, and that it doesn't have to be all about the marketing sales funnel and clicks, and it doesn't have to be about those conversions. You can just care about people and genuinely look for ways to serve people. Think about what's profitable use of your time. And with just a couple principles, you can develop a business model that will be profitable for you.
We'll be hearing now from Leslie Samuel.
If you want to be famous,
you are looking for the wrong thing. for me personally. You know, I think there's a lot of hype around this concept of fame. Everybody wants everyone to know them. To me, that's not what you want to be striving for. It's not the fame. For me, it's about, personally, it's about helping people. It's about having an influence. And those are the things that I strive for, because to me, those are the things that can help people live better lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're striving for that, the fame can just come as a result of the important things that you're striving for.
The best way to grow your blog is...
The best way to grow your blog is know exactly who you're trying to target and what exactly their pain points are, and start creating content to help them through that pain point. That's the first part. The second part is then getting it out there. How do you get it out there? In a number of different ways, but the thing that you want to think about is, how can you provide value to people? How can I provide value to your audience? How can I provide value to you as a blogger or you as a podcaster? Stop thinking about yourself and start thinking about others.
Was Jesus a blogger?
Was Jesus a blogger? I think if Jesus were here today, he would be blogging. No, when you think about it, Jesus was, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot recently. Jesus was a storyteller.
Okay.
Jesus went into situations where, you know, people might try to catch him in a corner and embarrass him or something of that sort. And you know what he'd do? He'd just start to tell a story. He'd tell a story about a tax collector and a Pharisee. He'd tell a story about a son that ran away from home. He would tell these stories that are applicable to your particular situation. And then you know what you would do? You would picture yourself in those situations, because you've been in those situations, and you would draw a lesson from it. For me as bloggers, that's the most powerful way to blog. It's not that you're saying, hey, I'm the one with all the knowledge, let me give you all the formulas. No, but if you can tell stories, stories that people can identify with, you'd be surprised at how many lives you can change. And that's what Jesus did. Maybe he didn't do it online on the internet or anything of that sort, typing on a laptop, but he did it. And that is something that fascinates me each and every day about him. It's about taking decided action and doing that one step at a time. And what you're going to realize is, once you start to take that action, you're going to learn things along the way that's going to make it so that some of the things that you used to doubt, you're no longer doubting. So in essence, you are starving the doubts, but you're not really focusing on those doubts. You're focusing on, what do I need to do today? What are the steps that I need to take to help me to get closer to my goal? And the closer you reach to the goal, the closer you'll reach to understanding that it is possible and you can do it. What are the reasons to start a blog? Number one, if you're trying to build something online, whether it's a podcast or whatever, you need to have a platform. You need to have a place where people can come and get your message, whatever that message is. I think blogging is a great way to do it. Now, we tend to often think about the hundreds of millions of blogs that are out there. However, there's no blog out there like the blog that you can create. There are no people that are 100% alike. Every individual is unique. And once you embrace that and you start to let your uniqueness come out, you can build a platform that stands apart from all of those other hundreds of millions of bloggers. So many bloggers come onto the scene over the last year, over the last few months even, and they're building extremely successful blogs. And they're not building it by going out there and saying, man, there are so many blogs out there, I don't know if I could do it. No, they're just doing it. They're putting up content. They're creating content. And the way I like to look at it, they're creating content to inspire others and even change the world. If you have a message that you want to get out there, you have to have a platform.
Up next is Philip Taylor.
You, your wife, and your daughter ran into a lot of ups and downs when you were making that decision and then finally made that leap. How did you starve the doubts during that chapter of your life?
Yeah, that's good. That was a challenging time. In some ways, it's still challenging, but starving the doubts, that's a good question. One of the things we did before, I'm a very conservative guy, so one of the things we did before I made that leap from corporate career, my finance career, over to financial blogging only, was to obviously have a stacked savings account in terms of paid off. All our debts were paid off except for our home mortgage. So our finances were in a very strong space, place, and also have pretty good career in terms of having my CPA, having an accounting background, and we're here in the DFW Metroplex where it's pretty sheltered from a lot of what went on in the past couple of years with the employment situation. So I'm maybe not answering your question. So how did we starve that doubt? So we were fearful. We were scared. And it turns out my wife, for the most part, is conservative just like me, and she wanted me to stay in my corporate job. But it turns out in my corporate job had me traveling a lot, 3 weeks at a time to far off locations. And now that we had a child, it made it more challenging on her and her situation. So she saw the value of me maybe trying this at least for a little while. Sure. So what we did was we said, let's do it for 6 months. Let's do a 6 month experiment. I think is what we said. So we knew we had the cash saved up to live off that for at least 6 months. And then at that point, at that 6 month mark, if the business hadn't taken off, I would look for, you know, a job again. Accounting jobs are pretty easy to come by in this area. So I could jump back on the corporate finance world pretty quickly. Another fear we had, and this was probably underselling this fear, was private insurance. So private health insurance. And so since we just had a baby and, you know, had a little kid, I had my wife to take care of who's not working. She's staying at home with our child. Right. I would be the only source of income and insurance. And so at the time, in Texas, insurance wasn't that great on the private market. And so it was challenging. It was fearful. But we didn't let that fear rule us. We didn't let that fear guide us. We chased down that fear and grabbed it by the neck and said, okay, let's actually go look at health insurance on the private market. What are the costs? What are they actually covering? And how, you know, what can we do to make up the difference if something does happen? So that's what we did. We just broke up the numbers, basically. I went to ehealthinsurance.com. We ran some quotes. I mean, it sounds simple now, and it is, in my mind, simple now. But at the time, it was sort of a big hurdle for us to clear. And so that's some of the ways we did that in that first initial launch for that first 6 months. So in terms of chasing self-employment, I mean, I would say don't be afraid to be a part-timer. I was a part-timer for a long time, and don't be ashamed of that method or that style. I did it for 3 years until I was really secure in a place where I felt comfortable moving on. So I would say, first off, don't feel the rush to necessarily be 100% full-time entrepreneur right out of the gate. Take your time, maybe test the waters with the part-time entrepreneurship effort on the nights and weekends like I did. In terms of starving the doubt, I would just say chase down those fear points you had. Like, if you feel yourself fearing something that's preventing you from getting to the next stage in life, you stare at it and you go straight for it. You don't run from it. You don't worry about it. You don't hem and haw about it. You actually stare that thing down and you go for it. So in my case, it was things like a bad job market, things like our savings and our budget, things like health insurance I've already talked about. And so I attacked each of those points. I went straight at them. Instead of just letting them build up within me and worry, you know, I actually went after them. And that's what I would say. I don't know if I'm articulating that well, but that's kind of how I remember going through that phase, was just taking them on head on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And don't allow there to be mystery. That's the worst thing you can do, to fear something that is a complete mystery. It's okay to fear something that's reality. And sometimes there are things that are reality and that prevent you from making decisions or prevent you from getting everything you want out of life. But don't let an unknown fear make a decision for you in your life. Chase it down and get the information about it.
Our next guest is Jeff Goins.
So this book is different from previous writings that I've done in that it's a memoir, which is to say it's a bunch of stories about my life. But it's not really about me. It's about that thing that we all feel, which is that wherever you are right now, whatever you're doing, chances are you're waiting for something. You're stuck in this place between who you are and who you'd like to be, between being a single person, you know, just running around doing your thing and really wanting to settle down and have a family, or between having this job and the next job, or sitting on the toilet, you know, as a woman looking at that stick waiting for it to turn blue. Everybody is waiting for something, and they're in this place that I call the in-between. And the book is about my own struggles with that, and then also my reflections on that. And this book is an exploration of the idea that maybe this space is actually, it's a divine space. And I say divine because this place that we want to escape, but it's actually the perfect place to be. It's the place where we grow and become who we're meant to be. And what we find, I think, is that life really is all waiting. You're never done. You're never complete. There's always something else to achieve, something else to hope for. And once we understand that and embrace the in-between, we can learn to live these fulfilling lives, these extraordinary lives in these ordinary circumstances, wherever we may be.
Jeff, from the outside looking in, some would argue and say, Jeff, you've arrived. What could you possibly be waiting for at this point and at this stage? And I'm curious, what are some things maybe you are waiting for in terms of your writing or being an entrepreneur?
Well, I think the trap of quote-unquote success, whatever that looks like for somebody, is, you always want a little bit more.
Sure.
And I can't remember who said this, but a person once asked a young entrepreneur who wanted to, take over the world, how much is enough? And he said, just a little bit more. And frankly, I think there is this tension in my life, whether it comes to fame or success or whatever, because we all have these numbers or achievements in our mind that if we got to there, this much income, that many fans, this many books sold, whatever it might be, we would go, I would feel complete. And then you get there, and like any summit, any mountaintop, you go, oh, it keeps going. It's just a little bit further, just a little bit higher. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having aspirations, but I do think that we as human beings need to understand that you can always go further, you can always move forward and challenge yourself to the next level. And part of me as a writer loves that because I can always get better and I can always take another step forward. But there's also the ugly side to it, which is I could always make a little bit more money or sell another book. And I don't want to get lazy. And I like that challenge of wanting to take the next step, go to the next level, particularly in my craft. And I don't feel like I've arrived. And I feel like I still have yet to master the craft of writing, but I'm excited about the journey. And so I have to learn how to embrace where I am and go, right now, this is good. This is the perfect place. This is the best that I can be right now. But if I stay here, I'm going to stagnate. But I need to embrace where I am and not be feel perpetually miserable about not being good enough. I love that Leonardo da Vinci quote, art is never finished, only abandoned. And I think every step of the way and us pursuing our life's work, our art, we have this choice to keep working to finish it. And we're not finished with it until we're dead, or we can abandon it. And sometimes the challenge, the hardship is that we face makes us want to abandon it, which is the wrong thing to do. And so I'm constantly facing this challenge of I don't feel good enough and I want to kind of take the next step. But as I'm taking these steps, I want to enjoy the view. I want to enjoy the journey. And so for me, it's not so much looking back at what I've accomplished, because that's relative. To somebody further down the mountain, they go, wow, you're way up there. But then I look up at where I have yet to go and I go, no, I'm just not even halfway up. But I think what it really means is, man, I am loving this. I am loving climbing every step of the way. And some people say that they don't like writing, but they love having written. I don't feel that way. I love writing. And sometimes I'm afraid to do it. Sometimes I'm really petrified of failure. Sometimes I am lazy about it and stall starting because I just don't know what to say. But when I'm actually sitting down typing and words are coming out, I feel alive. And so that's what I want to continue to do. I love what I do, and I want to remember that I love what I do. And I still have more mountains to climb, but I love the act of climbing.
Hey, we just had a chance to listen to 21 entrepreneurs. And Jared, I really appreciate you taking the time to put this together.
Johnny, I really appreciate you helping me with this process. I hope that people will come over and check out what you're doing at johnnyleephillips.com. If these interviews resonated with any of the listeners, I hope that they'll consider also checking out the podcast interviews at starofthedoubts.com. Again, starofthedoubts.com. And in the meantime, always do your best. Remember to treat others the way that they want to be treated. And remember to starve the doubts.